short course on computer viruses. My name is Fred Cohen.
This is normally an all-day class, but since we're teaching it in segments, the coffee breaks in our slot.
I'd like to begin with a formal definition. So much for that. The way it works.
This is a picture of the formal definition, which is actually much more meaningful and helpful to normal human beings. Unless you're a mathematician, this is a better myth. Basically, this is a short course on computer viruses. My name is Fred Cohen. This is normally an all-day class, but since we're teaching it in a short course on computer viruses. My name is Fred Cohen. This is normally an all-day class, but since we're teaching it in segments,
the coffee breaks in our slot. I'd like to begin with a formal definition.
So much for that. The way it works. This is a short course on computer viruses. My name is Fred Cohen. This is normally an all-day class, but since we're teaching it in segments, the coffee breaks do not apply.
I'd like to begin with a formal definition. So much for that. The way it works,
this is a picture of the formal definition, which is actually much more meaningful and helpful to normal human beings. So unless you're a mathematician, this is a better move. Basically, the notion of a virus is derived from the formal definition of things called viral sets. A viral set is a set of sequences of symbols that reside, in this case, in a semi-infinite tape, with a finite state machine controller, aka also known as a Turing machine. So we have a sequence of symbols on the Turing machine. Alright, that's one of these V's or V prime here. A viral set is a set of sequences of symbols that might reside on the Turing machine, where if the Turing machine is started in the initial state at the initial cell of any of these sequences that are an element of the viral set, and the machine is started, then at some time later, somewhere else on the tape, another element, possibly the same, possibly a different element of that viral set, will be written somewhere on the tape where the original one was not. Okay, and that's what makes it a virus. So what you can see from this picture is, well, the first thing is replication. So if we had a singleton viral set, we would have a virus V that produces, that's the whole viral set, and it could reproduce itself and produce another V. So it'd be a strict replication. And you can just make copy after copy after copy. If you have a V that can generate some other element of the viral set, V prime in this case, then that's an evolution. Okay, and you can imagine, for example, that we could create a virus that could evolve from V to V prime to V double prime and so forth through any finite number of these things. We could build various structures of evolution so that starting at a variety of different places in the space of viral sets, we could hone in on a particular virus or a particular sequence of viruses. We could also have infinite evolution. For example, we could have a virus that adds one byte or one cell, one Turing machine cell to it each time it runs. And then it would have an infinite size viral set because it would get larger every time forever. In fact, it would you could line it up with the countable numbers, with the number of integers. Okay? So there are potentially infinite number of viruses, elements of viral sets. There's some other interesting properties of that we'll get to later. I want to talk for a moment about how the working definition of computer viruses and how computer viruses work in normal computer systems. Basically, the working definition originally from 1983 and first published in 1984 was the virus is a program that can infect other programs by modifying them to include a possibly evolved version of itself. So if program P1 at time T1 is infected with a virus B and it's owned by user U1, and at time T2 user U2 runs program P1, then by virtue of the fact that user U2 has authority to write program P2 that user U2 owns, at time T2 user U2 can overwrite P2 with a virus B, and thus the infection takes place. And similarly, if at time T3 user U3 runs program P2, it can infect program P3 with the virus B. So it spreads from program to program and from user to user, for example, in a normal time-sharing environment. An alternative definition, which I think is sort of preferable for normal use, is that a virus is a program that reproduces. What I mean by reproduction, either replication, making a strict copy, or copying with change, that is evolution. So it's a program that reproduces, is a virus.
And that's the best linguistic definition.
This is an alternative explanation. It's called the secretary's analogy, not because it's about secretaries, which it is, but because it's the way I explained to my secretary back in 1984 what this computer virus thing was all about. And here's what I did. I explained that suppose we had fantasy secretaries, not real secretaries who are thoughtful, but fantasy secretaries that do whatever you tell them to do and follow instructions to the T. And imagine that the way these secretaries worked was that they had a bunch of note cards at their desk, and whenever the boss told the secretary to take dictation, for example, the secretary would take out the take dictation note card from the list of note cards, read what it says, and do it. And that's how the secretary would take dictation. And then furthermore, if Secretary 2, for example, didn't have a note card, for example, meant to write a memo, that secretary might ask other secretaries for a copy of their note card, write a memo, so that they could then write a memo and do the job well. So you can imagine that if we placed an instruction on one of these note cards, for example, the write a memo card, if we placed an instruction that said, copy this sentence into all your other note cards, and if today is January 12th, burn all your files. Okay. Then as soon as the secretary was told to write a memo, then all the other note cards that the secretary has would get a copy of that sentence. The secretary would faithfully write them on those note cards. When another secretary came to borrow that one of those note cards, it would infect all of the note cards of that secretary. And so it would spread from note card to note card, from secretary to secretary, from office to office, as secretaries move between companies, from company to company. And on January 12th, there'd be a lot of fires. Now, early on, when I started to do research into viruses, I took a decision not to publish the code for actual computer viruses. This decision was taken for more than 10 years until there were so many computer viruses out in the world that publishing another one didn't hardly matter in terms of any negative effects. But the reason was I didn't want to provide attackers with ready code to do the function. At the same time, I needed to do something to publish how these things would work so that the research community could try to understand it and we could get a mathematical handle on it, computer scientists could understand the principle and so forth. Of course, what actually happened was the reverse. The malicious people said, oh, this is obvious. I know I can turn this into code very easily, and they did, whereas the legitimate computer science community said, no, it'll never work. And so the virus writers were the people that were actually willing to try it. But in fact, I didn't want to do harm, and I still don't want to do any harm to anybody. So I still use pseudocode to explain how viruses work. So in the language of this pseudocode, this is a code for a virus. It starts out, the program is called B. It starts out with a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, which is a marker that marks the beginning of the virus. It's handy, but not necessary for viruses to have these things. Then it has an infection subroutine. In this case, the infection subroutine has step 1, which is a loop that says, get a random executable file that's in the environment, and check if the first line is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And if it is, then go to loop. Go look for another one. And if it's not, then prepend V, that is this program, into that file. So basically take this program and add it to the beginning of another file that doesn't have this program. It'll do that file after file after file, and that's how it spreads. And then there's a couple other subroutines. There's do damage and trigger. The main program says, in fact, if the trigger is pulled, do damage and go to next. Next is the end of this virus. So that if this thing prepends itself to another file, then after the virus runs, it will go to next. That is, it'll start running the program it was attached to the beginning of. Okay? Okay, so if it doesn't do any damage, if it just reproduces, and if it does it quickly, you may not notice that it's there, and the programs will execute normally. Now, the trigger pulled can be any condition that you want to start doing damage, and the damage routine can be any routine you want. So you're limited only by what kinds of programs you're capable of writing and the capabilities of the environment that this program runs in. Here's an example. We'll take that generic and we'll turn it into some specifics. Here's a denial of service virus. This has a subroutine, a triggering subroutine that says if the year is greater than 1999, then true, otherwise false. So it'll trigger starting on January 1st, 2000. Here's the do damage routine. It's an infinite loop. So what will happen is every infected program, as of that date, as soon as that computer says it's that date, it'll go into an infinite loop. And if this is spread to many, many programs on many, many computers, then many, many computers will go into infinite loops and everything will just climb through a hole as of that date. Now, one of the first things I did after I wrote an example virus and did some experiments that we'll talk about later was I looked for beneficial uses for viruses, and the first thing I came up with was a compression virus. Now, these days you're used to zip and unzip and automatically unzipping executable programs. But in the days when this virus was first written, there was no such thing. This was the first program of its sort that would do this kind of function. And here's how it works. The infection subroutine is a loop that gets an executable file. First line 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, it loops and looks for the next one. And if not, it does the following two steps. The first step is that it takes program P2 that's not infected, and it compresses it into P2 prime using a standard off-the-shelf compression algorithm. And the second step is it prepends this virus to program P2 prime. Now, if the virus is relatively small and program P2 compresses well, then the infected version will be smaller than the original. So you actually have less space consumed in the infected program than in the original program. The main program is, in this case, it asks permission whether to infect. So that, for example, you might call this program with an option that says, and infect. So you might say, run the program, - infect, and it'll go and infect other programs if it sees them. And so it's not a Trojan horse. Okay. One of the main complaints about viruses is that they hide themselves. This is not a virus that hides itself. It's out in the open. It says, I'm a virus. It identifies itself clearly as a virus. I'm a good one. I have a beneficial function. So if infection is what's asked for, then it'll go through the infection process. Otherwise, here's the infected program P1 prime with computer virus attached to it. It'll go to step 3, which is to decompress P1 prime into the original program P1. And then after it's decompressed, run program P1, the original uncompressed program. Okay? So what happens here is, if this spreads throughout a computer system, then we can typically save 50% of the space taken by executable programs. And the viruses are fairly small. So if, for example, we only infect programs that are larger than 10K, then we can save just about half the space in a typical computer system by implementing this virus. Now, in exchange for this space reduction, we'll have an increased time. That'll be the time taken to do the decompression. However, it turns out in practical systems that the loading time of the program takes much more time than the time it takes to decompress it. So for substantial size files, this is actually takes less space and less time than a non-infected program. So it runs faster, it takes less disk space to run than the original program. So there's this time versus space trade-off that you can get with compression virus. In some cases, you get both time and space advantages. There are some other things that you can now try to do. Suppose I wanted to detect this virus. Suppose it wasn't so obvious and it was trying to conceal itself. There are a couple of techniques that people came up with in the early days of countering viruses to try to detect these things. One of them was a simple checksum. You can do a checksum on the original programs and verify it later on. Well, it turns out it's pretty easy if you compress this file to calculate the checksum of the original program P2, calculate the checksum of CV plus P2 prime, and then add the appropriate bytes onto it so that the checksum comes out the same for the compressed version as for the original version, so it has the same checksum. Another example you could do is to check the size. Well, it would be very easy, for example, if the compressed infected file is smaller than the original, to make it the same size as the original just by adding some empty bytes to the file. So you can make it the same size, the same checksum as the original file. In fact, suppose we do the CRC, a circle redundancy check, which is another form of a checksum that's more complex. It turns out we can also write a virus that will generate the same CRC, the same checksum, and the same size as the original uninfected program. So those techniques and those sorts of techniques for detecting the presence of viruses are ineffective against an intentional virus writer with the malicious intent of concealing something. There are some other sorts of damage that might be interesting to talk about. For example, a data-diddling virus. This would be a virus that randomly changes a few bits in some randomly selected program a few times per day. Okay, so it infects, say, all the computers in your network, and on each computer it changes two or three bits in two or three files every day. Okay, the net effect, of course, is this slow, eternal corruption of your files and your data. Your systems make wrong decisions, they make mistakes, things become corrupt, but it's not so nasty that you notice it right away. It will also, of course, embed itself over time because you won't detect it very quickly. It's not doing massive immediate damage. It'll embed itself in time. For example, we'll get into your backup system. You may, you know, start to believe that these are the real legitimate files and so forth. Another example is the random deletion virus. Now, we don't have as much of this these days, but I think it's going to come back because we have enormous things that we're trying to store in file systems. Historically, there wasn't enough disk space to store every program everybody ever wrote and every data file we ever collected. So what we would do is move things to secondary storage. Dick, I'm sure you remember this. Right? This is not many years ago. It's just 5 or 10 years ago, certainly it was done commonly. What happened is files that were unused in, say, the last 10 or 20 or however many days would be moved to tape storage automatically, you know, at midnight Sundays, some such thing. And that would prevent us from running out of disk space. And if you ever needed one of those files, you'd call the computer center. You'd say, I need this file from 6 months ago. In fact, they might even leave the name of the file and a notation that says it was on the backup tape of, you know, July 12th, you know, 1823 or whatever the date was. Pretty old backup tape, I don't know if it would restore too well. The idea of this virus is what it does is it goes and infects things in the system, and then it looks for programs and data files that are just about to be moved to secondary storage. And one in every 10 of those, it just deletes. Okay, so it was when it was going to move to secondary storage. So all the other ones got moved to secondary storage, but one in 10 just got deleted before it got moved. User was notified of the other 9. Users typically don't remember which file was going to move to backups on which date. The file's gone. They'll assume, oh, well, probably got moved to backups. It has been a couple of months. They go look in the backups, and they can't find it. It's nowhere to be found. And it sows distrust between the computer center and that whole process of moving things to secondary storage. Now, of course, probably there were things you moved to secondary storage you could never get back anyway, right? Every once in a while, yeah, well, that's how it is. Maybe that was what it was. Well, I don't think so, but...
Can I just give you specific examples?
Yes, yes. No, don't. Please, thank you. Well, so that's a random deletion virus. Another one is the production destruction virus. This is, for example, suppose you're in the steel manufacturing business, and we put a virus into your production facility, so that on Tuesday afternoons, between 3 and 5 p.m., it'll change the temperature of the third stage of your steel cooling and annealing process to give you worse quality steel. And it'll do this whenever there are more than 2 but less than 5 users and no supervisor account logged in. So when the supervisor comes in and logs in to try and debug the problem, it won't be there. And the normal number of users for this control system, say, is 2, 3, or 4. So if there's too few users, it won't do it, or if there's too many users, it won't do it. So it conceals itself nicely. What happens is, you get poorer quality steel than you should be getting, and your competitor then has some market advantage. In fact, in a competitive steel business, it might be worth millions of dollars a week to put this little cell bug into the process control of the other company. And if they were debugging it, they would never tell. You know, you debug the program, it runs right every time. You have a question?
Yes. Okay, I ask you, why do you think the random deletion virus is going to be coming back?
Oh, I don't know if the random deletion virus is going to be coming back, but I do know that we're starting to run into the same problems we had a long time ago of not being able to store all the data that we want to store on our systems. You may have a 10 or 20 gigabyte hard disk, but you go out and cruise the web, you can pull down 10 or 20 gigabytes of image files, you know, just by visiting a few porn sites. So
So certainly there are lots of people that have large amounts of data. If you're doing large-scale simulation, you generate gobs of data. I do data collection from sniffers. Right? I sniff traffic on networks and collect data, for example, for corporations to do forensic analysis. You come up with gigabytes a day easily, 10, 20 gigabytes a day. You can't store it online. You can't hardly move it off the CDs. You need a big tape, and every day you fill that tape up and you go to the next tape. So for the large data user, it's necessary to have some means of storage that's more cost-effective, more space-effective, and works better and for longer than disks. Yes, question.
The reason I started this talk by describing the virus that the program that reproduces itself over time. I was seeing the need for reproduction in these examples.
All right, the question is why reproduction? And the answer is, I'll get to it in another slide or two.
Okay.
The short answer is, I don't want to avoid your question. The short answer is, you can do any of these things with a Trojan horse, but with a virus, you have a delivery system to deliver your Trojan horse all over the world. And the point of those examples, of course, is that a virus is a carrier for any damage you want to bring along. I just wanted to suggest some notions about the kinds of damage that you might be able to bring along to get you started. You can think of your own. I'm sure each of you can think of 10 new kinds of damage that I've never written down, and they would be all creative, and maybe the contest is who can do the worst damage, or better yet, who can find the most useful application. That would be a beneficial virus. And we'll get to that when we're near the end of the one. Some other types of damage, the protection-changing virus. You can just randomize protection settings. So readable files become unreadable, unreadable files become readable, writable files become unwritable, unwritable files become writable. Executable or not executables are. Set UID privileges are set for untrusted programs, and so on and so forth. Now, one of the things to note here is that in typical computer systems of today, they're on the order of 1 million protection bits. Right on a Windows NT box, certainly in any mainframe, certainly in any Unix or Linux box, there are a million to more than millions of bits of protection information. And we don't have any systematic way of setting them or changing them. So what that means, of course, is if I just randomly change those things, not only wouldn't you know what was changed, you wouldn't know how to reset it right. There wouldn't be any mechanism you could use to figure out automatically what all those settings were. So you'd have to manually go and reset those millions of bits. And meanwhile, the program is moving along, randomly changing them in the background. So this would create a great difficulty. I'm not aware of anybody implementing this in the real world yet, despite the notion having been around for 15 years or so. Network deadlock virus, so for example, the internet virus of 1989, you typically think of it as the internet worm. Worms, it turns out, mathematically are subsets of viruses. They're programs that reproduce, but they don't do everything that you normally do. They don't normally infect a file. They just reproduce using the environment. The IBM Christmas card of 1988, very similar to the recent viruses that we've seen. So the internet virus was a case of a program that reproduced by exploiting a sendmail debugging routine. It reproduced executable code. It grew exponentially and took down, I guess, 6,000 of the 60,000 computers that were in the internet at that time. So 10% of the internet was taken out of action. And it was directed only against, I guess, Suns and Sun 2s or something like that. So it got essentially all the population of computers. And various interesting things happened around that time. One of the interesting things was that everybody that was dealing at that time with that network communicated with other people on the network via email, and so none of them had telephone numbers or addresses for anybody else on the network. So when the network was down, they couldn't get the network working again. So one of the things they learned was to get copies of phone numbers, and they formed shortly after that, I guess, the CERT as a central place to call, but I wouldn't rush to call them. The Christmas card of 88, of course, was earlier than that. This was an example of an email-based virus that affected mainframes. Up until a couple of years ago, people were still claiming, but viruses won't affect mainframes or Unix boxes or any or time-sharing systems. Of course, they will. There's nothing here that is specific to the operating environment. All the things I've talked about will work just as well in a mainframe or a time-sharing system. Another claim was that they don't infect or they can't infect through email. And, of course, they did infect through email. And just as some of the more recent viruses infect via email, in this case via attachments, in the case of the Christmas card, it was a very similar mechanism. So the various email viruses, the AT&T outage of 1991 is another example of a virus. In this case,
is a protocol level virus, where
the protocol of the switching network was slightly modified, and so there was a protocol element that reproduced between switches, and it reproduced so quickly that no other traffic could flow. It was all sort of emergency supervisor traffic that was flowing, consuming all the bandwidth between telephone switches. So that's, and it's another case of reproducing software, in this case reproducing packets in a network, similar to the echo viruses that work in UDP in the IP protocol. This is a good one. I like to talk about the executive error virus, because this is it's another beneficial use of viruses, if you want to call it. It's a means of promotion within a company. Basically, you insert the virus as data in a spreadsheet if you're a vice president, and it spreads from spreadsheet to spreadsheet. Eventually, it gets into the CEO's spreadsheet. And what it's designed to do is check and see if it's the CEO's spreadsheet. If it is the CEO's spreadsheet, then it'll put in wrong numbers, but only for the CEO. Do wrong calculations. The CEO makes mistakes, eventually, you know, gets in big trouble because of making all his mistakes, and the vice president moves up. So this is a promotion mechanism for the corporate ladder. It was pointed out to me by several executives that, of course, this is completely infeasible because no chief executive would ever actually be able to use a spreadsheet like this. That used to be true. Nowadays, there are a few CEOs that can use spreadsheets, but the promotion is still there. Early on, one of the issues was, will trusted computing bases, so-called secure operating environments, mitigate the virus problem? And so here's an example of how a trusted computing base works. For example, this is called the Bell-LaPadula model of computer security. You might have unclassified, in-between, and top-secret data. And the rule says that unclassified information can be read by people in classified domains, but classified information can't be read by unclassified people. And similarly, you can't send information if you're a top-secret user. You can't send any information down to an unclassified user. The unclassified user might be able to send information up to a top-secret user, and it prevents the leakage of secrets. So, now the problem, of course, is that viruses are not a secrecy problem, although they can be used to leak secrets. Fundamentally, they don't do things by leaking information. They do things by corrupting information. So in this case, if the unclassified user starts out with program P1 infected with virus B, and a classified user runs the unclassified program, then the classified program P2 gets infected with virus B. And similarly, at a later time, the secret user runs program P2 and can write program P3, which is a secret program. The virus can infect the secret program. And similarly, if the top secret user runs P3, then it can infect P4, and so forth. So the virus spreads from the least trusted to the most trusted user in the system, which tells you what the notion of trust is in the system. It certainly isn't what we're talking about. Of course, if a top secret user wrote a virus, it could not link down to unclassified, because the unclassified user could never run the classified program that top secret user had created. So the most dangerous user in the system is the one that we trust the least. Turns out that in any system that shares resources in a non-fixed fashion, there's something called covert channels. A covert channel is a channel for information flow that was not intentionally set up as a channel for information flow. It's just a means that information can flow from place to place, even though it was not designed to do it that way. So an example of a shared resource is disk space available. So if I'm a classified user and I want to send a message to an unclassified user and we're sharing a disk, I can use all the disk space to indicate a 1, and then 2 seconds later, free all that disk space, use no disk space to indicate a 0. And over time, I can send a stream of 1s and 0s by using or not using disk space. Okay? And according to Shannon's information theory, published in 1948, no matter how much noise I can induce into that channel, I can send information at an information rate that's equal to the signal-to-noise ratio times the bandwidth of the ability to manipulate resources. So CPU time for tasks, paging behavior, printing delays, resource locks, file locks, temp file locks, so forth, are typical covert channels. And all trusted systems today still have covert channels, and it's the nature of sharing resources. So you can imagine then that we can launch a virus that would go up to the top secret level and then leak information through covert channels. And in fact, in experiments that we did, we found out that we could leak information through covert channels as quickly as CRTs at that day could display the information. So
So by writing a virus in a so-called trusted computer system, we could leak information as quickly as we could leak it by logging in as the trusted user. So that was not very good. Send commands up, get answers back.
Virus in a network, typically, you know, it'll start in a normal PC on the network, and normally it'll spread to a file server. And then from the file server, it'll infect other machines within the network. So the file server is sort of a central point for sharing information. A typical example was in Novell Network, there's a login executable program that would get modified by a virus that worked, was designed, I don't remember the name of it at this point in time, but it would infect the login program, and if everybody logged into the file server, they would get infected with the virus, and it would spread through Novell Network lands in a matter of minutes. Certainly in the morning, you come at 7:30 in the morning, if everybody else gets in at 8, and you load the virus up, it's going to get the whole network by about 8:15. So you asked the question earlier, Dick, about the difference between viruses and everything that came before viruses. And it turns out there are three fundamental differences. First one is generality, next one is range, and the third one is persistence. Okay. Generality, a virus is a delivery system. It's a general purpose delivery system. You can attach any damage, any warhead to that missile that you want. So the virus can deliver whatever damage you want through a complex sequence of places to a target, and then selectively cause the damage at the desired target. Okay, so that's a fundamental difference between viruses and things that come before it. That is a specific hole. You know, I know some vulnerability in Windows NT that lets me gain access to the supervisor. Okay, that's a very specific vulnerability, but a virus is a general class of vulnerabilities. And it doesn't depend on any specific vulnerability in a specific operating system. It depends on the fundamental notions of sharing information and being able to run general purpose programs. So it's a much more fundamental sort of thing. It's a similar in notion to a Trojan horse. It's a fundamental problem that we face. The second difference between virus and everything that came before them was range. And whereas before viruses, when you wanted to launch an attack, you could maybe break into one user's account and read what that user could read and write what that user could write. And if you knew a further exploit, you could use that user account to become another user on that system and read what that user could read and write what that user could write. That was the extent of your attack. And you got to take manual step after manual step after manual step to get from where you started to some target point. With viruses, the range goes from one, or at least very small, finite, to potentially infinite. I can launch a virus, and it'll spread automatically from system to system to system to system, go from user to user, from system to system, from network to network, spreading through the transit pleasure of information flow. So it goes from a finite and small range to an infinite range. So that's a fundamental difference between viruses and everything else, that they have unlimited range. And the third difference is persistence. Other things, typically, once you get rid of them, they're gone. So in the case of a virus, you might have a program that's infected, you back it up, and then you clean up all the programs on your system, you restore from backups, that virus comes back and it'll spread back to all those other computers in your system. So unless you wipe out every copy on every backup, on every tape, in every transmission, in every piece of email, everywhere, that virus still exists. And it can rear its ugly head again sometime in the future. Okay, turns out there are three high-risk activities, and those are sharing, programming, and changes. So all we have to do is eliminate sharing, eliminate programming, and eliminate changes, and we'll have a perfectly safe environment. We'll have no virus program problems. And I thank you very much for attending the course. Any questions? Well, you guys aren't very open about these things, but you might ask the question, what if we haven't want to do, like, share information or write programs or make changes? Well, then things, just in case you were going to ask that question, I prepared the next 140 slides. I just want to summarize what we've spoken about so far. First of all, viruses are programs that reproduce, evolve, or infect, all of those things, some of those things. They spread from program to program, user to user, computer to computer, network to network. Their unique properties are their generality, persistence, and range, or extent is another word I use for it. The defenses are no sharing, no programming, and no giving away information you receive. It is an integrity problem and not a secrecy problem.
So more access controls, more encryption, right? Encryption is not going to save you from viruses, right? Better secrecy systems is not going to save you from viruses.
I want to take some time now to talk about the early experiments with computer viruses. We've seen many, many demonstrations of late. Most of the things that you've seen in the last 10 years from computer viruses, all the things in the last 10 years, most of the things in the last 15 years, we knew 15 years ago. And we knew because we did the theory and then we did the experiments. So these are the experiments that were done early on. The experiments were performed to demonstrate feasibility. Early on, we weren't really sure you could write viruses for all sorts of systems. Nobody had ever done it before. To determine spread rates, you know, how quickly can this thing go from program to program, from user to user, computer to computer, network to network, and then to verify or refute the theoretical results. In each case, permission was obtained before experiments. I want to note that if you don't get permission and you perform an experiment with a computer virus, you're probably doing something illegal. Now, lots of people do things illegal these days, I understand that, but nevertheless, you might decide that you want to check first. We avoided implementation flaws. Early on, people said, oh yeah, you wrote a virus that worked against, you know, VMS. But VMS has known security holes. Yeah, but we didn't use those security holes. Okay, we didn't exploit some error in programming of the operating system. We didn't exploit some known flaw. We exploited the normal way that the system is used. The fact that users share information, that programs are general purpose because they all have Turing capability, and that information travels transitively. That is, if A can give it to B and B can give it to C, then A can give it to C. Those are the only properties that we exploited. And those are policy flaws. Those are fundamental policy issues that we allow sharing, we allow programming, we allow giving away what you receive. System names and locations will remain confidential by request. Nobody yet has said, yes, you can use my company as an example of how quickly a virus spread. If I get any volunteers, it's only been, this is 99, and this started in 83. So it's only been 16 years, and nobody yet has agreed. But someday, somebody might. So I can't tell you, for example, whether or which of these experiments might have been under Unix, or VMS, or TOPS, or MVS, or SCOMP, or TSS, or VM, or DOS, or Windows, or OS2, or any other operating system. So I'm not going to name any of those operating systems as places where we did experiments. The first virus was conceived of on November 3rd, 1983. It was actually demonstrated November 10th, 1983. It was a blank computer running the blank operating system. The NSA asked that the system names and operating system types remain confidential until they are safe from these attacks. That's the policy of how the security community is supposed to talk about these things. So we're still waiting, right? Because whatever operating systems were vulnerable then are vulnerable today and will be vulnerable likely forever. So according to that rule, we can never tell you what kind of computer this was on or what kind of operating system. However, you may be able to guess, I don't know how. The purpose was to demonstrate the feasibility of writing computer viruses. The purpose was to measure the takeover time. It took about 8 hours to write the first virus. Take about a half a second to run. Remember, this is on a time-sharing system in the middle of the day 16 years ago, 1983. At that time, you know, the fastest computer, the supercomputers, were slower than your PCs are today. So a normal time-sharing system is like like a palm-top computer supporting 40 or 50 simultaneous users. Okay? And a virus infection took under a half second. Starting a typical program took several seconds. Okay? Not unusual to take several seconds to start a program. You remember this stuff, did, right? Certainly, those time-sharing systems took a while. So this infection time was unnoticeable. If you put it in cycles today, this program would do an infection in, let's see, we're probably four orders of magnitude faster today than we were 16 years ago. It's a factor of 10 every 3 years. 16 years is 5 orders of magnitude. So a half a second divided by 10,000. Right, so it's a 20,000th of a second would be the infection time for this virus in a computer today. Okay, unnoticeable, right? Pretty darn quick. It demonstrated the ability to cross user boundaries, which was the only kind of protection afforded on the system.
The code size, it was a 200-line programmer. It was written in C. Now, if this doesn't give away the operating system, I don't know what does. But I'm not going to tell you. By the way, 200 lines is an awful big virus, right? And the reason it was so big is because it was designed to be able to trace it, to control, to make sure it didn't go where it wasn't supposed to go, and that we were able to clean it up. So of those 200 lines, probably 170 or 180 were the ability to trace and disinfect, and the safety measures and the ability to track it, and the rest was the actual virus. Number of attacks we launched were 5 in this experimental basis, and in each case we achieved complete system takeover in 5 to 60 minutes. Between 5 minutes was the fastest and an hour was the slowest to completely take over a time-sharing system. In equivalence, suppose you have a computer network today that has 50 to 100 users, it's running in the middle of the day, you launch a virus, you've taken over the entire network in 5 minutes to 60 minutes. It's approximately the equivalent demonstration. Okay. That was the first virus. By the way, when this was done, nobody actually believed you could do any such thing. Nobody had ever done this before. No, it was, they had just completed the trusted system evaluation criteria. They were about to accept it as sort of the godsend of computer security. And the whole notion of this was sort of beyond the scope of what people were thinking about. Now, of course, it's an everyday affair. The next set of experiments we did that were worth noting are experiments against one of these double paginal-based systems. It was a system designed to protect secrecy, and similar to most of the systems currently designed to protect secrecy. No different from the best secrecy systems available today, really. March 1984, negotiations began, and by July of 1984, we were able to perform experiments at some military base in somewhere in the western United States. I could probably even say somewhere in the southwestern United States without giving too much away. That's only about a third of all the military bases in the world, right? And many, of course, are closed now, so you don't know what you're with. It was a proprietary 1108 military brand operating system that no longer exists, running on, an 1108, which I don't think there are any 1108s left anymore, are there? I think the last one was dead and buried 5-10 years ago. So I guess the results were reproduced then, but they wouldn't be easily reproduced today. The purpose was to demonstrate the feasibility. It took about 18 hours by someone who had never seen an 1108 or programmed this operating system before to write a virus, starting with, how do I type commands? How would you maybe log in? It was an ugly program. It took 20 seconds to do an inspection. Very, very slow. It was an ugly program. It was 200 lines of Fortran 4. 10 lines of assembly language and 50 lines of command files. Okay, this was an ugly program. And in fact, I can tell you, I've seen ugly programs, and I've written ugly programs in my day, but this was the ugliest. I mean, it was an assembly routine called by a Fortran routine to run command programs that would cause the Fortran program to copy and compile. I mean, ugly, ugly program. Okay. So after doing this demonstration, I went into the room to explain the demonstration that I was going to now do. I was going to do the live demonstration before the people in the room. It included the two people that I guess wrote the operating system, or the proprietary operating system. The two authors were there. The commander of the base, some guy who was in an unmarked suit from an unknown place, who was there as an observer, a silent observer, and a couple of other people. But one form or another. And I described what this program was going to do. It was going to spread from untrusted to trusted to classified. And they said it was impossible. Now, it's just impossible. Now, if you've ever done a demonstration, there is no better environment for doing a demonstration than an environment where somebody who built the thing you're about to demonstrate on is standing right across the table from you saying what you're about to demonstrate is impossible, cannot be done. You can't do it. Now this is what's fun, right? So I did it. I ran the program and demonstrated it spread from untrusted to classified to top secret. And the guy that wrote the system, kind of said, "You're the worst programmer I've ever seen. This is the ugliest program I've ever seen. I can write a program that did the same, that would run in a half a second and go through the system like a hot knife through butter." And I said, "That's the point." So he got the point. So this was done in March or July of 1984, and in the 1984, the trust and system evaluation criteria was just about to be approved. There was no integrity required. It was vulnerable to this thing, and the systems that were vulnerable to this attack were approved. And it just sort of proves the political momentum wins out over technical details every time. Another thing we wanted to do, wanted to do an experiment on a network, but networks in those days weren't maybe as easy to get for experiments as you have it today. I mean, one of the reasons you have a network to experiment with today is that I wanted a network to experiment with 15 years ago and couldn't get one. But instead of doing an experiment, we were able to get somebody to give us permission to do instrumentation. So instrumentation means that we looked at the behavioral characteristics of how the network worked, what program was run by what user at what time, and we did an analysis that said, if you put a virus here at this time, where would it have spread? Okay, so we took full details of what was run from where, when, by whom, analyzed what the virus would do, and figured out, in theory, where it might have gotten to, and how quickly.
Was one of these blank computers that are in a blank type of computer network. The purpose was to confirm or refute prior results. It took 8 hours to develop the instrumentation by an expert. Turns out the minimum time to take over the whole network was 30 seconds. The average time was 30 minutes, and the maximum time is 48 hours. Interesting phenomenon. The reason that it was 48 hours maximum is if you planted it Friday after everybody went home from work. Nobody came in until Sunday night when they logged in from home to pick up their email from the weekend, at which point the virus would spread on the average in 30 minutes and take over that one. Turns out if you announce a program that had an infection on a bulletin board, it would spread the whole network in about 10 minutes on average. This was determined to be because the first people who would run the program were the systems administrators, who would run the newly announced program that was on the bulletin board. They would run it from their systems administrator account. It would set to rerun all the machines and rapidly take over the whole network. It just took 10 minutes between the announcement and when they bought it to run the program or when they got the announcement or what have you. We identified a set of social users. Users who tend to run a lot of programs other people write and write a lot of programs other people run. And it turns out that a lot of the spread of viruses goes through these social users. Okay, think about this. Relate this to biological disease. Right? Venereal disease spreads through social, people that have a more rampant social behavior, prostitutes. Right? People that have sex with a lot of people spread sexually transmitted diseases. Software people that run a lot of programs from other people and write programs other people run tend to spread computer viruses much more quickly than others. So if you slow down those social users, you can dramatically slow the spread rate of these infections. They'll still eventually reach epidemic proportions, but you might be able to slow the rate down to where the epidemic is not as bad and you can get the prevention or cure out there before a lot of people get infected. For example, right now, people use bulletin boards to announce new spreadsheets with user IDs and passwords to pornography sites. And that's how they launch their newest viruses. Their macroviruses get launched that way. It's very typical. So if you could slow the spread through those social things, you would not have things like the Melissa virus. They would just not get that far that quickly. They would get to a few places, you would detect them quickly, you would prevent that large-scale social spread, you'd get the cure out in place, and you'd have much, much less overall effect. You'd never get the pandemic. You probably wouldn't even get to epidemic proportions. There were also psychological effects. Now remember, these were the days, not like today, where everybody's used to getting computer viruses all the time. These were the days when nobody ever got one of these things before, and everybody considered their area and their computer their private domain. You didn't have a whole bunch of PCs sitting around that you shared with other people. You had one user ID and one computer typically, and you spent hours and hours and days and weeks and months there. It was private. It was yours. So once the announced results, most of the administrators immediately refused all further experiments. I mean, it was fine to do an experiment as long as they thought it wouldn't work. But when they determined you could actually do this thing, they said no. No more experiments. So we demonstrated feasibility for many systems and networks, but further experiments were refused after they found out that the first few were acceptable. And the first few experiments demonstrated that it worked. Nobody else would allow the experiments, just demonstrations on lung systems. Most administrators refused to even allow analysis of sanitized log tape to determine spread rates, so how quickly it would have spread in their system. They just didn't want anything to do with it. Initial fear reaction
is what we're seeing here. And it's typical, actually, of rape victims. This is sort of the same thing, that rape victims experience this terrible fear, and they feel like they've been violated, and it's the same for users of computer systems who have sort of trusted their privacy to the system, and somebody invades it. And we see that a lot today in the internet. People break into computer systems of naive users in the internet and start looking at their private files, and people feel violated, and rightly so. There are some fairly long-term statistics. Different colors, we have in blue the number of antivirus products, which is leveled off or started to shrink now. In yellow, we have the number of papers written on viruses, which was one in 1984 and up to 10 in 1989. Grew sort of exponentially up until about 1990, and it's been linear, just a constant ever since then, because there are so many conferences, and that's all the papers that will be sustained, and that's that. Stories on computer viruses, this is the media effect, they peaked around 10,000 stories in 92 on computer viruses. These days, of course, we probably have 10,000 stories in the first 6 months of this year. So that's because of the internet viruses have driven this up in the late 90s. And then the actual number of viruses, a lot of people were saying it's going to grow exponentially forever, but of course that's ludicrous, because there are only so many individuals writing computer viruses. Okay, so once all of them are engaged full-time in writing computer viruses, it's linear. They can only write so many per day before they fall asleep. They don't get exponentially better. The population of Earth is not actually growing, I guess, quite exponentially anymore. So you're just not going to get an exponential growth of anything forever. So it started to sort of level out. Although in the last 6 months to a year, we've gone from 20,000 computer viruses to 40,000. Almost all of those are minor variations on macro viruses. So there's a little step function, but that's also going to even out as people get bored with writing a minor variation. They'll never get bored. Trends in computer virus complexity. The first experiments were 83 and 84. The first nil-spec system takeover was demonstrated. In 86, University of Texas, El Paso, they did experiments on 60 computers. They took over 60 computers in 30 seconds. Okay? Now this was another classic experiment. These college students were doing this experiment, and there was a standard IBM PC network at the time, and they sent the virus up, and they said, go, and then it spread. And they said, oh, no, it spread. Then they thought, oh, my God, we unleashed this thing. If we let it get out of this network, we're in big trouble. So they literally ran through the building to every computer connected to this network and walked out of the ran up to the computer and shut the power off and ran to the next computer through the building to stop this thing from accidentally getting on a floppy disk or going to somewhere else. Now, needless to say, some of the users who had been typing for 4 to 6 hours without saving their files were not very happy when somebody came and shut the power off on their computer without telling them where or anything. Just click. Hey, wait. And they're gone, running to the next room. So they decide not to do any more experiments. But so now that's actually pretty quick, right? That's more than one per half second. That's one every half second. That's just about as fast as a virus could typically go. Given the computing speed and networking speed, that's faster probably than any of the computer viruses that we've seen since then. Maybe. In 87, the Lehigh virus spread to 250 systems in a matter of days and destroyed all the information on all of those 250 systems and spread to some others, but it was cured. The brain virus in 87 was launched, and it was first detected at the University of Maryland. It was written, I guess, by Ashan and Ahmed or something of Lahore, Pakistan, and put their name and phone number in, but nobody bothered to call them for 4 months. wonder where it came from. Ashan and Ahmed, what's that? Phone number in Pakistan. It couldn't be from there. Call them up. We've been waiting. Why didn't you guys call? We left our phone number, guys. All right, so that worked then, and that would probably still work now. The brain virus might still work on your PC right now.
Yeah.
It's floppy board. It's on a big floppy, so it might still work. And it's still, certainly still there up to a couple years ago. In 87, the Hebrew University virus infected 1,000-plus systems, and that was still spreading as of a couple of years ago in common EXE files in PCs, although most of those files are now
of such a different format, they won't run in many systems. 87, the first Amiga virus. Now, this is a classic. This is a virus that ran against the Commodore Amiga. Has anybody ever heard of a Commodore Amiga? It's like a history for you guys, right? But there was a computer called a Commodore Amiga. You know, it's wonderful, you know, being old enough to think that I'm now a history teacher. What I'm talking about, but to me, was like novel new stuff. So they called this virus the Swiss virus. Okay? Anybody want to venture a reason that they might have called it the Swiss virus?
Creative holes.
What was the first idea?
Creates holes.
Creates holes. Oh, clever. No. None of those are true. You know the reason they call it the Swiss virus? Nobody knows the reason they call it the Swiss virus. Somebody said, we'll call it the Swiss virus. And it was. Nothing had anything to do with Switzerland. It wouldn't have anything to do with holes in the system. Somebody speculated it might have come from Switzerland, called it the Swiss virus, and it stuck. That was it. No reason to believe it ever came from Switzerland. There were four types of these, and it's a classic tale. The first one came along, and it set the first byte in the boot block of the system to some value. And so the people at Commodore came up with a defense against it. They had a program that looked for the first byte, like set to 4. That this is an infective system and cured it. Okay? Replaced that boot section. Now, the virus was rapidly modified to come up with a 5 instead of a 4 as the first byte. At which point, I called the people at Commodore, wouldn't you like to have a better solution? They said, no, we've got it handled, and they had a program that looks for a 4 or a 5 in the first byte boot sector. At which point, the third variation came out that had a 6 in the first byte of the boot sector. And son of a gun, they checked now for the first byte of the boot sector being the legitimate first byte. At which point, variation 4 came out, which changed the second byte of the boot sector. Okay, so they may still be at it today, maybe up to like the 8th or the 9th boot sector byte today, except that Commodore is now, I guess, out of business, and the computer doesn't exist. But as far as I know, through the entire life of this computer system, all they ever did was move towards the next byte of the boot sector in terms of their defense. And they're out of business. Okay. In 87, there was an IBM virus that spread to 500,000 plus users. This was the virus that spread through IBM mainframes via email. Yes, it's possible. Yes, it's been done. Now we all believe it. 500,000 plus users spread there in about a day and a half. It was actually over a weekend, so it was on Friday. It started out, nobody ran it until Monday, and then by Tuesday, it was 500,000 plus users. It was a global email mainframe virus. One of those for good characteristics. In 1987, during a strike in Germany, there was a virus written to intentionally slow down a German computer. Just a virus written by some of the employees before they went out on strike to slow the computer processing. So that was one, I guess you could call it practical, although certainly there's a one-sided perspective. 1988, the MacMag virus. It was the first time, I guess we can say that the virus technology was then mature because it was used in advertising. It was part of a peace message. It was a message, the universal message of peace on the anniversary of the release of the Mac 2. That's what that was about, okay. And that was spread by a magazine, the MacMag magazine, spread it intentionally. Scores virus on Macs. This was one of the first viruses that really did a good job of surviving attempt to destroy it. Basically what would happen is it would just get throughout the floppies on backup, so we had a substantial delay between infection and harm. So that would get backed up to floppies and so forth. And you go clean the entire network. In fact, there was one large government agency that several years later said they were still getting it on a weekly basis. It was corrupting their files. This is after years of going through and cleaning all the systems every week for this virus. It would always just come back on somebody's floppy from somewhere. Right? They did this for years without coming up with any sort of a real solution. The internet virus, aka the Morris worm, it was 50,000 computers were affected in a couple of hours. So let's see, 60,000 computers in a few hours. Is that faster or slower than 60 computers in 30 seconds? 3,600 seconds per hour, 3,600, about the same speed. Okay, some speed of light thing there, I guess. The first Japanese virus was detected in 1988. The AIDS disk was physically mailed out to 30,000 plus PC group users. I guess it was magazine subscription owners by somebody in the United States who just sent the disk out that they had this virus that was so poor it would really never reproduce, but it would harm systems. Spread it out to the users despite corporate policies against putting floppy disks into your computer system. So all the users put the floppy disk into their computer system, ran the program, got their disks corrupted, and it cost a lot of money. First widespread evolutionary viruses were in 1989. The first widespread simulation virus was in 1989. This is a virus that interprets its own code. So it's actually a code interpreter. How these things work, well, every one of them is different. Evolution started in 89. Multilingual started in 89. These are 88. These are viruses that exist in multiple languages. So maybe it's written in a spreadsheet, but it can also infect a Word document. And Word documents can affect other Word documents and spreadsheets and so forth. Or they'll run in, there was one example, a demonstration that was a binary program that would run both on a PC and on an 8080 and a 68,000, 6800. So the question for you is, how would you write a program that will run on both a 68,000 and an 8080 chip? A binary executable that will run properly on both machines and infect on both machines. If you've heard the answer in a class before, don't speak up.
No, it's not recompiled.
It's a binary executable program.
It doesn't recompile itself?
It doesn't recompile itself. The same bits are loaded into both computers, and they work successfully on both computers. All right, you can think. Don't give me maybes. Think and figure out something you know will work, and tell me before I get to the end of the slide. Bugs or operating system weaknesses are exploited in most of the actual viruses. Most of the viruses are written for PCs, and they exploit the fact that there's no protection at all on the PC to get to the operating system file. But for example, the Word viruses don't exploit this at all. All the macro viruses don't exploit that particular capability. And certainly the other viruses that have been written for mainframes and time sharing systems that don't do that. The network-based viruses don't do that particularly. In 91, people started to write toolkits so that you could go to a menu and pick out, gee, I'd like a virus that goes off on my birthday, the damages, deleting all the files of .com extensions, the message it puts out is, Joe loves you, spread in com and exe files only, don't spread over networks. Okay, make it. And if we'll put out an executable for you. Just provide you an executable file which you can now put into a computer somewhere